Good afternoon, everyone. I'm here to talk to you today a little bit about NIJ's funding of a study that came out of New Jersey. As I'm sure you're all familiar with, the birthplace of Megan's Law was in New Jersey, and we thought, given that fact that coincided with the 10-year mark of the implementation of Megan's Law, that it had been a good time to really apply for some funding that would track some long-term outcome of what we were seeing in that state. And when we started to look at the literature, we saw that presently all 50 states had some version of SORN, some version of Megan's Law, as well as the District of Columbia and many countries abroad. So we started to ask ourselves, well, all of these states have these laws. What really is the effect? What's happening? What can we see as the likely outcome of what we've implemented? So we realized that despite this widespread support for these registration and notification laws, there was little evidence, if any, that supported any type of reduction in first-time offenses, which we saw through protective measures or general deterrence, or any literature on sexual reoffense reductions, which would be through protective measures and specific deterrence. So to provide you a little background of the study, the National Institute of Justice awarded myself as well as a number of colleagues this grant in 2006. And what we're looking to do within this grant that has since ended was to compare a potential pattern of sexual offending rates specific to New Jersey. So before and after the implementation of Megan's Law. What I should also note here is that within the context and within the interest of time, I'm presenting to you two phases of this study. There are actually three phases to this NIJ study, the last phase being a cost-effectiveness analysis of Megan's Law specific to New Jersey, which, again, in the interest of time, I'm leaving out. But as Elizabeth has mentioned, Elizabeth and I are working on an analysis of that. Also, we've been able, from the results of this study, to parlay a number of different analyses specific to sex offender registration and notification, particularly whether or not sex offending characteristics and predictors of recidivism have changed over time. So we were able to have this 10-year time span of sex offending recidivism information. And what we were able to also do outside the scope of this grant was to analyze whether or not those risk predictors of recidivism changed from when we started to see Megan's Law implementation and risk assessment instruments being utilized to where we are now. Because as we know, our risk assessments haven't changed all that much. Okay. We were happy to see that risk predictors of sexual recidivism remained stable over the 10-year time frame. So they hadn't changed a whole heck of a lot from what we saw from our research. So there are two different phases to this research, and I'm presenting you the methodology on both of them. The first was a simple pre- and post-research design that determined whether or not there were significant changes in the rates of offenses reported by law enforcement agencies prior to the implementation of Megan's Law and after the implementation. We looked at rates for sexually based offenses, non-sexually based offenses, and drug based offenses from 1985 through 2005. We utilized data from all 21 counties in New Jersey, as well as the aggregate form of New Jersey as a whole, utilizing, again, Uniform Crime Report data. What we did was look at the prevalence rates for rearrest, reconviction, and reincarceration over the time frame, and we compared population estimates from the Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics. These population estimates for New Jersey were cross-referenced with the source book of criminal justice statistics, and there was no significant difference between the population estimates between the sources. So we utilized UCR data for the data that was significant, obviously, for the study. Again, as we all know, one of the limitations that I'll discuss in the last section are the limitations of utilizing official data and arrest report. We also thought it was necessary to not only take sex offending data, but also to look at non-sexual offending patterns over this 20-year time frame, and also drug offense patterns. The reason that we chose drug offense patterns was because we've seen, specific to New Jersey, very similar legislative pathways. So we thought it would be interesting within these time frames if we could take all of this information and sort of fit it into the context. Phase two of this grant had a very, very different methodology. We utilized the sample of sex offenders that were released from the New Jersey Department of Corrections. So all of the offenders in phase two of the study were convicted sexual offenders. They were released either from our Adult Diagnostic and Treatment Center or the general population. In New Jersey, we are one of only two states in the country that have a prison facility specifically devoted for the treatment of sexual offenders. Those sex offenders are incarcerated just like they are in general population, with the exception that they receive treatment specific to sex offending. Okay, so we utilize 50 sex offenders per year, 25 from the ADTC and 25 from the general population. We randomly selected them for these 11 years from 1990 through 2000. This yielded us a sample of 550 cases of sex offenders. Within these 550 cases, we collected quite an assortment of data on each individual offender, approximately 100 variables on each offender. They ranged from historic information to demographic information, sentencing, and reoffense patterns for each individual sex offender in the sample. Phase two analyzed these pre- and post-group differences on three specific outcomes that we were interested in. The first was the most obvious, the reduction of recidivism. We thought it would be in our best interest to utilize a sort of triangulated methodology here and look at rearrest, reconviction, and reincarceration. We were also very interested in increased community tenure. What we meant by increased community tenure here was the number of days it took to the first arrest for general offending and the number of days it took to arrest for sexual offending. The reason that's important is because whether or not you see a statistically significant reduction in recidivism is, of course, the hallmark of your outcome study. But if an offender is also staying in the community at a longer time span prior to recidivism, that in some ways is still a very significant outcome because we start to see cost benefits, a number of different benefits that can be gauged from that. We also looked at reduced harm. Within the context of reduced harm, we were interested in whether or not the obvious happened. Are there fewer sex offenses occurring after the implementation of Megan's Law? Within that, we were also interested whether or not offenders in general were less violent. Okay, so whether or not the sample of sex offenders after the implementation of Megan's Law, whether or not they just happened to be less violent offenders, and whether or not we saw offenders who had fewer child victims. Because we know for the majority of, through the majority of research, Megan's Law is going to focus primarily on those individuals that have those child victims. So it was important for us to really gauge whether or not we were seeing a reduction there. The first results you see here are for phase one, and all the next few slides I'll point out to you are all for phase one. The rates varied here, so you'll see on the bottom portion, the x-axis of your scale here, starts you off at 1985 and then brings you up to 2005. So what you see here at 1994 is the point of implementation for Megan's Law. The rates varied from a high of 51 offenses in 1986 to a low of 29 offenses per 100,000 individuals in the population in 2005. In general, we saw a consistent downward turn of sexual offending rates over this 20-year pattern. What you're looking at here is the rates before and after the implementation of Megan's Law. The upper line represents sex offenses for the years 1985 to 1994, and the lower line represents sex offenses for the year 1995 to 2005. Superimposed over these data points is a linear trend analysis that will ultimately provide us the information to see whether or not the slope has increased or decreased over time. The first thing that should be noted from what you're looking at here is that beginning in 1995, which is your bottom line, the rate of sex offenses have never again approached the pre-1994 levels. The intercept and the average of these two lines are different. And the second important thing to take home is that the slope is deeper in the post-Megan's Law period. This is particularly notable for us for the fact that these are sex crimes, and we all know that sex crimes have a low base rate of offending, so one wouldn't necessarily expect to see a steeper drop-off of these rates. Now, when we do the same with our non-sex offenses, just to sort of get it into context, we see that the average number of crime has been changed to per 1,000 population. And the average is 50 crimes per 1,000 individuals at the highest, and the highest is 56 in 1989. We see here at 1994, again, is the point at which Megan's Law was enacted. The lowest rate we see here is in 2003 at 45 non-sex crimes per 1,000. For the last 5 years of these data, we ultimately see that the crime rate has remained stable. There is a significant change point, however, if you look 4 years past the 1994 at 1998. For these data analyses, we utilized what's known as a Mann-Whitney U-test, which rank orders all of your data and is particularly useful for individuals when you don't know where your data points change. Okay, so within the non-sex offending rates, we saw a significant data change point at 1998. These are what our statewide drug offenses looked like for the same time frame. Rates varied from a high of 89 in 1989 to a low of 52 in 85. Again, so we can see that in 1989, our drug rates spiked. There's no significant change point with our drug rates, our drug offense rates during that same time frame. This moves us over to our recidivism information for phase two of the sex offending study. What this does is present pre and post contrasts that are controlled by time at risk. So these are year-by-year graphs that analyze different data points for arrests, conviction, and incarcerations for the 10-year time frame. So this is phase two. Okay, so going from 1990 to 2000, 5 years prior to Megan's Law, 5 years post-Megan's Law. And again, it represents the rate of sex offenders released during these time frames. Overall, 46% of offenders were rearrested, 41% were convicted, and 35% were reincarcerated. And again, this is hard to gauge simply from this, and you'll see this in the next table that I'm about to show you. This is for general recidivism by year, so this is not broken down for sexual or for drug offenses. This is what became particularly important for us with our sex offending study, and this represents the outcomes pre and post Megan's Law. You'll see that at the top of the table, we have recidivism information. You'll see it broken down by pre and post total, utilizing either an ANOVA or a chi-square. Of particular interest are the top three. This weighs general recidivism. So within general recidivism, we took sexual recidivism out. Okay, so this is just general types of recidivism here. We did see a significant pre-post effect on general recidivism after Megan's Law. So on all three categories post-Megan's Law, we do see a significant reduction for general recidivism. When we look then at community tenure, as I explained to you, was days to arrest for any crime, so for our general recidivism, or days to arrest for our sex crimes. We see no significant difference within these two categories. So sex offenders are spending approximately 772 days in the community prior to Megan's Law before they commit any crime, and 726 days in the community prior to committing any offense after Megan's Law. Okay, we see slightly higher time frames pre-Megan's Law for sex crime, and then post-765. This didn't achieve any sort of statistical significance. When we look at harm, this is what, again, is the primary interest, particularly for us, because we know that our Megan's Law study is supposed to have an effect on sex crimes. So we show here the percent rearrested for any type of sex crime. Prior to Megan's Law, 10% of the sample was rearrested for any type of sex crime. After Megan's Law was implemented, 7.6% of the population had been arrested for any type of sex crime. Again, no statistical significance. When we looked at reconviction and reincarceration, we also did not see any difference. Also of importance was the type of sex crime. As I explained to you in the first few charts, we were interested in whether or not the type of offenses that sex offenders were committing actually changed over time. And again, we didn't see any change with that. We didn't see that sex offenders were committing crimes against a smaller amount of children or larger amount of women, adult women, anything like that. The only place that we saw a reduction was in the percent of violent offenses. We saw that post-Megan's Law implementation, sex offenders were generally less violent offenders, okay? And that reached a statistically significant level. Our survival functions, you'll see before you, considered our censor cases, so our time at risk here. Our offenders in our previous analyses were capped, so all offenders had the same amount of time at risk, which ultimately became 6.5 years. And you'll see from the graph that there's very little difference between the offenders pre- and post-Megan's Law implementation in terms of those staying within the community. This, of course, did not reach a statistically significant level either. So the results tell us that New Jersey has experienced a downward trend in sexual offense rates with the change point at 1994. This became a very important issue for us because ultimately what was happening was phase one of our study was indicating that sex crime rates were down, that they were down from the 20-year mark, and they were consistently going down, okay, which led many individuals in the community to surmise Megan's Law is having an effect because your sex crimes are down, okay. We then, when we moved on to phase two, did not see that same result. When we took our aggregate data and sort of de-aggregated it, we no longer saw that effect over time, okay? The majority of the counties, sex offense rates were higher prior to 1994 and were lower after 1995, which is ultimately when we know Megan's Law came into effect. But we couldn't in any way point to the fact that Megan's Law was having that effect. While sex offenses have rebounded somewhat, they're far lower than they were in the 80s and early 1990s. In terms of sex offenses, the general decline is similar to that of non-sex crimes. However, the statewide change point for sex offenses occurred during the time frame that we would have expected it to, around 1994, while our non-sex crime rate changed in 1998. The wide year-to-year fluctuations in drug crimes were, we assume, a reflection of our drug policies and our practice efforts, although those efforts have not been sustained over time. And in the case of sex offenses, we know the statewide change occurred when it was predicted to change, and we have seen that it's maintained that power, primarily the statistical power, over time. Again, when we look at the pre- and post-Megan's Law analysis, though, we see that Megan's Law was not effective in increasing community tenure, so they're not spending longer amounts of time in the community. It has not reduced the number of sex crimes. It has not changed the type of sexual reoffense or first-time sexual offense, and it has not reduced the actual number of victims involved with sexual offending. Before I move on to the limitations very shortly, just to say, again, this is something that we struggled with in New Jersey and had to be very careful with how we worded it in our final report to the Department of Justice because we knew that this information could easily be misconstrued, particularly within the media and the legislature, saying that Megan's Law was, in fact, effective. And we knew primarily that was coming from individuals that really didn't have a strong concept of the statistical analyses, when in fact this actually did happen, particularly with one of the state senators who drafted Megan's Law, ultimately came out saying that, look, Megan's Law is effective. You know, bottom line, are sex crime rates lower after Megan's Law was implemented, or are they higher? You know, and your obvious answer is, well, they're lower. And he said, well, you see, it's effective then. So, again, we had to be very, very particular in how we drafted these results. The limitations for this study are those limitations that we would see in most research, including official reports, particularly that of utilizing UCR data. We know about the underreporting, and we know about the low base rate of reporting. Particularly with sex offending, in all of our studies, it's become very difficult for us to achieve statistical power because we simply don't have enough sex offenders committing re-offenses of the sexual nature. And that is in no way advocating that sex offenders have to commit more sexual re-offenses for us, but what it does is make our jobs harder because of obvious statistical power. Okay? Thank you very much.